When her boyfriend turned up dead in the trunk of his car, she and her other boyfriend were the first to be blamed. She says all of the evidence is circumstantial and the media just made a feast of her personal life. See what you think. This is the story of Rosa Peral, the black widow of the Barcelona police, who says she was just scared into doing someone else's dirty work. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here, and hello to the usual rapscallions and reprobates. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. As a side note, today I'm celebrating 5,000 subscribers after 70 videos. I know I'm still a little baby YouTuber, but I really appreciate all of you who have been here since the beginning and those who have just found me but jumped on board enthusiastically. I'm doing a little giveaway as thanks, so please leave a comment on this video, any decently non-offensive comment at all, to enter. I'll put in extra entries for my Patreon patrons, and we'll let a random number generator choose a winner to send some swag to. Today's case was recommended by FirstLastEH2TF, and I was happy to research it since both the documentary and the series are having a moment on Netflix. The real-life version is called Rosa Peral's Tapes and is centered around interviews with the woman accused of the crime. The drama is called Burning Body and takes some liberties with the case, but is still great for entertainment. You just have to remember that actual people have paid the price for this crime. The case begins in 2017 in Barcelona, one of my absolute favorite cities in the world. My Spanish is terrible, however, so please excuse me for pronouncing everyone's name the American way. It was May 4th when a hiker called the police about a completely burned out car at the Foy Reservoir. The vehicle identification number belonged to 38-year-old officer Pedro Rodriguez, a father of two, but you would never know he was in the car. There was really no evidence to be found, aside from some ashes in the trunk and a prosthetic device on his back that didn't catch fire. I'm guessing it was some sort of back brace because Pedro had recently had back surgery. There were no fingerprints, no murder weapon, and it was almost like someone intended it to be that way. Someone who really knew what they were doing. Rosa Peral, the victim's girlfriend, was quickly arrested along with her on-again, off-again boyfriend, Albert Lopez. She had been telling everyone that Pedro left home after a fight, but all of his friends knew that he would have taken off on his motorcycle, not in his car. And Albert had made the mistake of asking a coworker a few days earlier how would he dispose of a corpse. The coworker said he would burn it in a car. Very convenient. Their GPS data also showed them in the area of the reservoir on the night of the crime, even though Rosa's house was 15 kilometers away. The two were held without bail while the judge decided if the death would be considered homicide or murder. Basically, because the fire got rid of all of the evidence, there was no way to prove if the crime had been done with malice. Rosa's lawyer would later say that the prosecution made up evidence to be able to charge them with the more serious crime, murder. The prosecution and the public considered it too brutal to get the lighter sentence associated with a homicide. Recognizing that they probably weren't going to get away with it, Rosa and Albert each accused the other of being the mastermind. Rosa said that she only went along with the cover-up because Albert had told her, "If you don't help me, I will make your daughters choke on their own vomit." Well, Albert said he only helped dispose of the body because Rosa was his girlfriend, but she had done the dirty work. All three of the officers at the center of this case, yes, they were all officers, were already no strangers to controversy and to the media. Pedro had been on duty working a police checkpoint when a motorist raced through it without stopping. Pedro chased the man and reportedly beat him up. Pedro was suspended from his job until the man withdrew his complaint. Meanwhile, Albert already had two assault convictions against him. And in August 2014, Rosa and Albert were working in a police unit that dealt with illegal street vendors. It was then that a Pakistani vendor named El Boniado, the sweet potato, died in suspicious circumstances that are blamed on Albert. The police report says that the record salesman attacked Rosa with a knife, and her partner, Albert, pretended to draw his gun on the man. This scared the sweet potato, who fell backward off an embankment of the hill they were on and died a short time later in the hospital. Rosa said at first in her statement that the man was alone when he fell, and that got Albert acquitted, but she allegedly later told someone that Albert had killed for her once before. Later in court, Rosa would say that she didn't see anything at all that day, but Albert told her he killed the man for touching his woman. In what is surely a coincidence, the third officer who was with them that day, the only other witness, died a year later in a motorcycle accident. Surely a coincidence. And Rosa herself had made news before in 2008 when she was only 23 years old. She had just joined the Barcelona police force and soon started a relationship with a detective sergeant. She says she eventually wanted to end it, but he didn't like that. So he got into her email account and sent out a photo taken of her going down on him to all of her contacts. And I mean all. He wrote a lewd message basically saying, "This is Rosa, and here are all of the things I like to do with the men I work with." When she reported it, the higher-ranking officers backed him up and said they believed she had sent the email. So she filed an official report, but these same higher-ups told her to withdraw it so she wouldn't ruin the sergeant's life. She refused. So her revenge trial started when she was already in police custody for killing Pedro, and you can imagine how much credibility she had in that trial while being held on murder charges. There was really no proof who had sent the photo to all of her contacts, so the sergeant was acquitted. And still to this day, people wonder if she sent the photo of herself to frame him. So none of these people were angels, and there was already a cloud of suspicion hanging over Rosa and Albert when they went to trial for Pedro's murder. The thing is, no one really cared about Albert, but Rosa made headlines. They called her the Black Widow of the urban police and said she was always seducing someone. They said this wasn't her first victim, that she was promiscuous. They said she was a topless dancer, not that there's anything wrong with that, but she wasn't. Rosa says this public lynching would have never happened if she was a man, that her personal life was seen as scandalous, and she had been tried in the court of morality before she ever got to her real trial. She met her husband, Ruben, when she was 16 years old, and he was working at a DJ in a nightclub. She kept requesting songs, but he refused to play any of them. But then as she was leaving, he came after her and asked to see her again. They got together in 2000, had their daughters in 2010 and 2012, and then got married in 2013. But Rosa said their relationship had always been very toxic, and they drifted apart after the girls were born. But of course, there's some evidence in Rosa's phone that they may not have been completely over. In 2012, the year before Rosa and Ruben were married, she started sleeping with her coworker, Albert. They were stuck working 12-hour shifts together, and things just happened. They just grew close. She says he listened to her and was present in a way her husband wasn't. She called them friends with benefits. She wanted more, but he didn't want a family, and Rosa's daughters came first in her life. She eventually divorced her husband, but not to be monogamous with Albert or anything. She started up a relationship with another coworker who liked to ride motorbikes with her. This guy, Pedro, was helpful and considerate, and unlike Albert, he loved her kids and wanted to build a real life with her. Rosa moved in with Pedro, but jealous Albert had to go and tell the guy that she had a side relationship with him. So yeah, people are gonna judge. Rosa gave her first deposition on May 16, 2017, and she said that on the night of the murder, they came home in the evening and put the girls to bed. She and Pedro were washing clothes in the basement when Albert texted that he wanted to talk to her. After a text exchange, she came outside her home and saw him jumping over her fence with a backpack. He was wearing gloves, and she was pretty sure the stick hanging out of his bag was an axe handle. He lifted his shirt to show her his gun, and although he didn't press it to her temple, she said he might as well have. That's how threatened she felt. He demanded her phone, so she threw it on the ground and then ran to the upstairs of the house. She locked the door behind her and paced nervously for a couple of hours, just trying to save her kids from him. Poor Pedro was alone in the basement, she said. Then Albert began pounding on the door, saying that she needed to come downstairs or he'd come for her and the kids. Wanting to protect her girls, she went to Pedro's car as instructed. She had to help Albert with everything that came next if she wanted to make it out alive herself. Albert says that when Rosa texted him to come over, Pedro's body was already in the trunk of the car, that Pedro had attacked her for starting things up again with Albert, and she killed him. Mysteriously, Rosa asked a friend soon after to borrow a van to move a sofa from her house. That sofa has never been recovered, and some say that's where Pedro was killed. Especially because that room with the sofa was orange in photos taken with Rosa's phone 2 weeks before the murder, while it had been painted white when the police first came to the house after Pedro's death. Blood was found on that wall and a light bulb above it. Trial began on February 3, 2020 for the 36-year-old Rosa, and her lawyer said her main job was to separate the sin of being promiscuous from the crime that was actually committed. The prosecutor admits that all of the evidence they had was circumstantial, but it was good evidence, so his main job was to figure out who had planned the murder. There were 50-plus witnesses who testified, and many of them admitted that, yes, Rosa had complicated relationships with different men, which, of course, the reporters ate right up. One said that she had an anti-monogamous pathology. She couldn't be with just one person. Journalists even told her lawyers that they were enthralled by the idea of this black widow who called the shots, that it made way better news than two men in a fight over a woman. I mean, this was a woman who sent erotic photos to her neighbor 2 days after her boyfriend died. That's juicy. Rosa said the prosecution and the media had to create a character because of the complete lack of evidence. The prosecution went so far as to ask every witness, male or female, if they'd been with her. But circumstantial or not, the evidence is pretty compelling. On January 12, 2017, Albert went to Rosa's house because he believed they were still together, but Pedro was there. They were living together. She asked Pedro not to get involved and to just stay in the house. She and Albert exchanged insults. Albert then wrote her an email saying that if he ever quit the force and stopped caring about his life, she'd be hearing from him. It was a threat. But he says that first she wrote him 77 emails saying that it wasn't what it looked like between her and Pedro and that they could still be together. She said that the day Albert came to the house and Pedro was there, he almost got physical and she became frightened of what he might be capable of. But the court showed that minutes after Rosa supposedly started being scared of Albert, she was writing him emails saying that she was his and only ever would be. She says she was worried he'd confront Pedro if she told him the truth because Albert was obsessed with her. She was protecting Pedro. 2 months later, in March, Albert reached out to Rosa through Facebook with a different tone. He was friendly now. He didn't care about Pedro. He wouldn't cause her any more problems. So in April, Rosa agreed to meet Albert. She said she wouldn't make plans with him alone to avoid any misunderstandings, but that she was with her friends that day, and he could stop and say hello if he was working. He came to her in his uniform and threw a ring at her. It was a symbol of the ultimate commitment that he wanted to go back to being friends with her and being her work partner again, and maybe something more if she was into it. And he did it in front of her friends, proving how serious he was. When Rosa later met a friend for coffee, she was wearing the ring from Albert on one hand and a ring from Pedro on the other, but she told her friend that in the end, she was choosing Pedro because he, quote-unquote, dresses and better. Rosa, of course, says that's not true. She says she chose Pedro because he showed interest in her children and in being her partner in raising them, not to take their real dad's place, but to be a special friend they could all rely on. May 1st, 2017 was the day of the crime. Rosa and Pedro took the girls and Rosa's parents to a house Pedro owned. They went to an amusement park, Rosa's mom took the girls out to eat, and Rosa and her dad helped Pedro in the garden until about 8 p.m. A ton of photos were taken that day, and the prosecutor says they're all meant to help establish an alibi. In court, Rosa stood by her earlier story that she put the girls to bed and then Albert came over, jumping her fence with the axe handle sticking out of his backpack and flashing his gun to threaten her. She says they took Pedro's cell phone and drove it near her ex-husband's house, and she realized then that Albert was going to try to frame her ex. Albert told her to follow him in Pedro's car to the reservoir, and Rosa was just frozen with fear. She did as she was told. At the reservoir, Albert retrieved 2 gas cans from his car and started toward her. She thought he was going to douse her and finish her off with Pedro, so she ran away toward the road. Her keys were later found near the road, lending some credence to the idea that she dropped them while running. Albert chased her down in his car and told her to get in or he'd get to her daughter's before she could. Then Albert drove her home and told her not to tell anyone what had happened. She said she wouldn't say anything if he just left her alone. And she sent messages from Pedro's phone in the following days to make it look like he was still alive. In fact, on the night of the murder, she texted from Pedro's phone, asking a friend if he wanted to buy Pedro's motorcycle. That phone was later found in her closet. Rosa claims that she was so afraid of Albert that she couldn't bear to go to the police. She had to do everything she could to protect her kids. But the prosecutor argued that she didn't even live nearby Albert, that it's not like he was a presence in her life, leering at her wherever she went. He said it's weird to say that you're afraid when the cause of the fear is removed. Rosa says you had to be there to feel the irrational fear she felt. She did, after all, have a history of mistrust with the police, even though she was an officer herself. She had reported the officer supposedly taking revenge on her and had been called a liar. And I think it's honestly believable that she wouldn't trust the authorities after this. But here's the thing, the prosecution had access to thousands and thousands of files from Rosa's cell phone. One of them was a file from April 19th, shortly after Albert had given her the ring. Rosa had recorded a voice message on her own phone where she uses a pet name, Tonto Bote, which means dummy. The message says basically, "Hey dummy, your phone is off. I went to the supermarket and got discount tickets for an amusement park where we can take the girls and stay the night." This was a name she was known to use for Albert. But Rosa says she calls lots of people this. But the prosecutor asked her to point to any other time in any conversation ever where she called anyone else that, and she couldn't. Her excuse was that she only says it verbally, so her kids don't hear her saying bad words. But the prosecutor was able to show that she had called Albert twice before she recorded that message for this person she called by his pet name. She called him twice, he didn't pick up, and then she said in her voice message that this dummy's phone was off. Who else would the message be for? Her lawyer said it was a loose file on the phone without any metadata. It only showed when the file had last been modified. So if there was no information about when the message was actually created, it could have been years prior. No one knows. However, the prosecutor showed that on the day the message was last modified, Rosa's GPS put her at that supermarket. So in the message, she mentions going to the supermarket to buy discount tickets, and on April 19th, when the message was last modified, she had been at that supermarket. I wouldn't blame you if that makes you think the message was created on April 19th. Rosa says she goes to that supermarket often. Her GPS would have shown her being there many days when messages weren't recorded. But she also says in the message, if we do that. Like, if we do that, we can go to the amusement park the following weekend. What is that? To the prosecution, she's clearly referring to the murder here. If you help me with the murder, we can go to the amusement park at a discount. Her lawyer says there's no way someone would really go to an amusement park the weekend after one of her boyfriends was killed. It would be too obvious. You'd need to put on a show of grieving. But here's the thing. Rosa and Albert showed up to lunch together the day after the murder. They laughed and took selfies. He had shaved off his famously long beard. These weren't people who were trying to keep a low profile. On April 20th, one day after that voice message where she talks about doing that, Albert bought a new phone that he only ever used twice. Hours after he bought it, GPS tracked him near Rosa's house, and around that time, she made a call to the new number. It wasn't activated yet, so the call didn't go through, but it was of course recorded on her phone. Once the number was activated on the evening of May 1st, you know, the day of the murder, the only two calls on it were to Rosa. Phone records also show Albert near Rosa's house on several occasions when authorities know Pedro wasn't there. She left Albert a voice message on April 25th where she said hopefully the guy would leave soon so Albert could come over. She says she'll ignore the guy so he leaves sooner. The prosecution says that isn't any way to talk about the guy you're in a relationship with, the one you've supposedly chosen over the other. But Rosa says she was just playing along, being nice so she could just get Albert over there sooner, return the ring, and be done with him. But at the same time, Rosa was also telling a friend, who knows what would happen if Albert would change his attitude and give her what she wanted, a committed relationship where he cared about her children. If the ring Albert had given her earlier in the month was an indication of that, Pedro was now simply in the way. So here's what the prosecution says happened. At 9:37 p.m. on May 1st, Rosa and her children arrived home. At 9:51, she called Albert, but the call was missed. At 9:53, she called again, and they talked for 4 minutes. 11 minutes later, Albert's new phone was activated. They believe Rosa gave something to Pedro during this time, something to knock him out. Of course, we'll never know because his body was turned to ash in the car fire that followed, but he was a big guy, even for two of them to handle. Forensic tests found that he had been hit in the head with a blunt object. At 10:08 p.m., Rosa texted Pedro's best friend that he was angry with her ex-husband, likely as part of the plan to frame her ex for the crime. Why would she be texting lies unless she knew Pedro was about to die? Albert came to her house, and the rest is history. At the trial, Rosa's ex-husband's new partner testified. She's listed in Rosa's contacts as puta, a Spanish curse word that I probably don't have to translate for you. This woman said that Rosa's older daughter had told her Rosa actively participated in the crime. The girl was given a public defender and chose to exercise her right not to testify against her mom, so she didn't appear in court. So when the prosecution asked this woman exactly what the daughter said, the judge stopped her from answering because it would have effectively gone against the daughter's choice not to testify. But the woman was allowed to show how the girl described the scene. The woman went ahead and talked anyway and said that the girl mimicked Pedro being walked down the stairs of their house that night by her mom like he was a robot, like he was out of it and barely able to function. This woman also told the police that the daughter saw Rosa covered in blood that night. Rosa says her daughter saw nothing. They were asleep, and this woman was lying because they've never had a good relationship. The woman, in response, says she's even eaten dinner with Rosa's parents in an effort for them to be a cohesive family unit for Rosa's daughters. Rosa and Albert called each other 50 times in the 20 or so days after he gave her the ring, but her lawyer says only 28 minutes of actual talking took place in that time. She says there's no way you can plan a murder in that amount of time. Of course, the prosecution reminds us that they also met in person on April 25th and could have met other times without their phones, or they could have sent more messages through an encrypted service. Rosa's lawyer says it's very dangerous to assume anything when it means someone might end up in jail. Rosa says she was investigated because she was the closest to Pedro, and the cops weren't able to consider anyone else once they got her in their sights. She says Pedro took her out the day before the murder because she was sad about her girls being with their dad. She says he consoled her and tried to cheer her up. Why would she kill him the very next day? But the prosecution said that if you spend a few hours with Rosa, she can make you believe that you killed Pedro. She was just a bloodthirsty kind of woman. Rosa was sentenced to 25 years in prison while Albert got 20 years. They each got the maximum sentence, but Rosa's was higher because she had a relationship with Pedro. kinship is considered an aggravating circumstance. Rosa appealed, but in September 2021, the Supreme Court stood by the original conviction based on the crime being premeditated. She's currently serving her 6th year at Mas Enrique Prison in Tarragona. She's gotten in trouble multiple times and has had to be moved 3 times. At one prison, 2 inmates accused her of talking about a plan to kill her ex-husband, but she said they were just in love with her and couldn't have her. Of course they were. Both she and Albert still accuse the other of being the mastermind behind the crime. Rosa says she's studying law, awaiting the day she's released and can have a normal life. Rosa asked that the Netflix drama not be allowed to premiere because it would violate her honor. She was ignored. And any proceeds from the Netflix show will be used to pay her victim, Pedro. Rosa and Albert owe his family 885,000 euros. As for the motive, no evaluation has ever shown Rosa to have any psychotic tendencies. A criminal lawyer interviewed for the Netflix documentary says courts don't consider common survival strategies for women in controlling relationships. Rosa may very well have resorted to conflict avoidance in order to deal with an increasingly jealous and raging Albert. She just went along with the disposing of the body to steer clear of his wrath. What do you think? Was she just protecting her kids? Is that believable? Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.